That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hey, this is David Scales. Before we get into today's show, I just wanted to remind you that the Rio Pro is coming up in less than a week. So if you want to participate in our Fantasy Surfer Club, all the directions for how to do so are on our website, surfsplendorpodcast.com. Just click on the Fantasy Surfer link, tab, page, and all the directions for how to set your team are there. And then also, if you'd like to wager, this is your reminder to get your wager in before the first heat starts. That's all done via PayPal. And again, the directions to do so are on surfsplendorpodcast.com. All right, lock in your team, send your wager, and we'll look forward to another exciting event. All right, enjoy today's show.
It's just bizarre that it's going to be, you know, a few years, it'll be 50 years, you know.
That is bizarre.
It's been amazing. It's been an amazing, amazing journey. A huge part of our life. All of, you know, our best friends that we have come through our work with the Bonzer. You know, wives, everything else. You know, we've met all through, you know, our work with the surfboards and
Life's work, man.
Yeah, so you know, it's just there's no separation basically. Yeah. So it's just it is what we do and is what we are. And Duncan does the same thing in Hawaii with Cafe Haleiwa and now with the Bonzer Front. They have a family business over there, and we just sort of with those two, his two businesses there and the surfboard business, and we just really, that's the way we approach it, is there's no separation between business and our life. So. I don't have the fear, and I want to rock your gypsy
soul. Just like way back in the days of old. That was the voice of Malcolm Campbell, who, along with his brother Duncan, created the Bonzer surfboard design. For all intents and purposes, the Bonzer is the first truly functional, high-performance, three-finned surfboard design. In today's episode, we discuss the Bonzer design, the role it's played in surfing, and the surf world's quirky social dynamics that sometimes push, but often impede, board design evolution. We're bringing it to you straight from Malcolm's kitchen in his home in Oxnard, California. I'm your host, David Scales, and this is Surf Splendor. You know I will be coming home.
Yeah, when that foghorn whistle blows. Well, we moved up here in 1966 with my parents. We grew up actually in the Pacific Palisades.
Oh, okay.
And we were there, like I say, until 1966. And I hadn't really started surfing until we moved up here.
Okay.
But we were always at the beach. My dad was a swimmer, body surfer, and they always had us at the beach. And so we were body surfing, skimboarding, bellyboarding, doing all that down the Palisades. And Duncan actually was standing up on a bellyboard probably 65 before we moved up, you know, before we moved up here. One of those old Malibu pop out belly boards that Jack Surf used to sell.
I'm curious, did you have an awareness of the Malibu surf scene at that time? I mean, that was pretty prominent at the same time, right?
Not personally. I mean, we would go up there every once in a while just for, you know, going to the beach. But we used to see, because we were at State Beach, right at the bottom of Chautauqua Boulevard. And so that's where we would hang at the beach. And back then, there actually used to be sandbars that used to break.
Really?
Now and again. And so we used to see Mickey Dora come down. We knew who he was.
Okay.
But, you know, we were younger. And again, like I said, we weren't really in the surf scene per se, just more of just the beach scene. And I was born in 52, so when we moved up here I was still only 14, so we were young kids. Duncan actually stood up on that, like I said, on the belly board. He was 11. When he was 11, and that was sort of the beginning of his surfing. But then we moved up here in 66 and to Oxnard Shores. And there really wasn't a big surf culture here. There was a lot of surfing. There was surfing going on, and obviously Rincon being a major spot, you know, up in Santa Barbara, world known, and so Yater and, you know, all that, the crew and different Wilderness crew and the beginnings with Greeno and all that was going on up there. But in Oxnard, there really wasn't a whole heck of a lot going on. There were a few good longboard surfers. But extremely uncrowded. Mm-hmm. There wasn't very many people surfing down here. And we were living at the beach, and so that summer of 66 is when 66 and 67 we started surfing.
Surfing on what?
I actually had a longboard I got that I think it was Phil Cabot longboard. And Duncan had a old kind of 8.6 Dewey Weber.
Wow.
And so those were our first real surfboards.
On the beach breaks in Oxnard, or where were you surfing?
Yeah, just here at the beach breaks.
Okay. And
Oxnard Shores, Hollywood Beach, and Silver Strand.
Yeah. How were the waves different back then, or
It's a little bit different. I mean, Silver Strand's probably more the same. Or this more was still as approximately the same as it was back then.
Okay.
But Oxnard Shores has changed a lot. Actually, in the 60s and the 70s, the waves were more consistently good. The sandbars were better. And I'm not really sure exactly why that happened. But during the 80s, it was really the sandbars would come and go a lot more.
Yeah. I wonder if any spots have actually gotten better over that time, or if there's new spots that exist now that didn't exist then. I suppose there's spots that you can ride now based on equipment that...
Well, I think more spots are ridden now just by the sheer fact that of necessity, because there's so many more people surfing. Because from the time we started and were able to get mobile, get mom's station wagon and cruise around, all the same spots, most of the same spots, the spots that everybody surfed back then are still surfed, with the exception of Stanley's. Stanley's is gone because of the freeway. When they expanded and built the freeway and the freeway on ramp right there at Seacliff. So Stanley's no longer exists. There was also a spot called Tanks, which is just south of Pitus mm-hmm. Point, that actually was a pretty good beach break, and that sort of disappeared.
Yeah.
But most of the spots, it's very similar to what it used to be.
You mentioned Yater in Santa Barbara. Who were building boards in this community, or who was building boards in this
there
community?
In Ventura, there was Surfboards Hawaii, so there was those boards. They had a shop, and Maury Pope, mm-hmm. obviously, was pretty big, and Bill Hubina, and... Dennis Ryder, which was William Dennis. They were early, and they both worked for Maury Pope and then went on their own. In Oxnard, there was Silver Strand Surfboards, John Schomer, And I'm not sure where Wes surfboards were built, but people were riding Wes boards, and there really wasn't too much.
Yeah.
So when we started, 68 was the first surfboard we shaped, and it was obviously the beginnings of the shortboard revolution.
Sure.
When just, you know, a foot at a time was coming off boards, and so that's when we, you know, when we started.
What was the motivation to start shaping?
Well, we always were kind of, well, my grandfather and my dad were both real crafty. They had, you know, wood shops and so forth. So we were tool users. And then the big impetus came, one of the reasons, because boards were changing so quickly. And my dad one day, he just said, he kind of saw the writing on the wall, and he just said, he goes, "Hey, you guys, if you're gonna try to keep up with the changes here, you're gonna have to learn to make boards on your own, because we ain't gonna be able to buy you a new surfboard every 6 months."
Yeah.
And or you're gonna need quite a job to support that habit at this age. So then we said, you know, what the heck, and stripped down the first. We, like a lot of people, stripped down an old longboard.
Yeah,
and that was the first board there. First board we shaped.
Yeah, access to materials was probably pretty scarce at that point, I would think.
A little bit. I mean, you could get, we were just learning. Actually, one of the, Dave Sweet was, they were doing some, actually molded, blanks that were almost, you know, finished surfboards. Hmm. It was actually pretty ahead of its time. I haven't really heard too much talk about that.
I haven't heard that story.
We got a board that was, I actually think it was a 6'8", and it was, you know, and we didn't have to, that was, we had done a couple boards, but then we did that one, and we didn't have to shape it too much, you know, we
really
took the skin off and you know, shaped it a little bit, and so we used that, and the Standard Brand sold resin and fiberglass,
mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you get a, basically, you could get the materials for a board for, you know, $35 or something. Between get a second blank from somebody and get a second blank and then resin, fiberglass, acetone. It was, you know,
we
stunk up our parents' garage.
Right.
And the house.
That's the way to start.
Yeah.
What were, like with that first board, for example, or maybe the first few, what were the designs that you were implementing? What type of boards were you building?
Well, initially we were just, I mean, the first board, we just hacked out a, you know, just a single fin board. And then we, as we started seeing more of what other people were doing, you know, we began to get educated a bit more on, you know, templates and so forth. But we gravitated very quickly to what was going on in Australia with the shortboard revolution over there. And we actually subscribed way back then to Surfing World. So some of our early boards were really influenced. Some couple of real early twin fins we did were, Terry, you know, sort of copying these little twin fins that Terry Fitzgerald and you know, Mark Warren and people were doing. And then also some of the shortboards, the more egg-like shortboards, mm-hmm. Other strange sort of little boards from Ted Spencer, mm-hmm. and Wayne Lynch, that stuff. So Midget Fairley. So we started looking that direction is where we went. So we made a few single fins. Then in 1970, we shaped the first Bonzer.
Which, I guess, would be the introduction of the three-fin surfboard, right? And it was 10 years prior to the Thruster, approximately?
Right. Yeah, yeah.
So where did that concept come from?
Well, we were riding some twin fins, and obviously we had a couple single fins. And we were just talking with my dad one day, and it was actually his original kind of thought. He said, "Why don't you guys?" He goes, "What about three? You know, what about three?" And so we sat down and we, with him, and Duncan and I, from, you know, our limited surfing experience, at least we knew how it felt to ride a, you know, ride yeah. surfboards and turn and so forth. And so we sat down and just kind of brainstormed what might you know, what might work, and what we came up with was basically off of, you know, evolving out of a single fin.
Sure.
So we placed the long keel shaped runners or fins forward of the center fin and out toward the rail. I mean, originally I think they were probably 11 and a half inches up, I think on the first board, and 10 and a half inches long or something. Mm-hmm. So we had looked at some boat design stuff and, you know, different things. And it was really just more intuitive than anything else.
Probably trial and error to a certain extent.
Well, yeah, the first one was just, yeah, trial.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we were going, the first one was, I think, 5'4 or something.
Oh,
again,
wow.
Again, that was because it was a little bit like some of those strange little boards that Ted Spencer and David Treloar and different, you know, guys who ride these wide tail, mm-hmm. short wide tail boards. And, you know, wide tails, some of them were twin fins, some of them were single fins. And, so we were just at that point, we hadn't learned enough to really know too much about, forging out on our own template yeah. shape wise. But, you know, we knew we were doing something different. And as far as it being the first three fin, we had done that one. And then a few months later, an article came out in Surfer Magazine and showed with Reno Avalera doing a bottom turn on a three fin board that he and Brewer had come up with. The difference, and we looked at it and we went, oh, you know, we were going, oh, no, somebody else is thinking about this too.
Sure.
The difference being their fins were set to the side and rear of the center fin.
Okay.
And they were sort of half moon shaped fins back kind of on the corner, you know, up from the tail a little bit, but still behind the center fin.
Sure.
As where ours were placed forward of the center fin.
And a different shape.
And more of a keel shape. So in a sense, they were both low profile,
sure.
you know, keel type fins. The biggest difference was we put the fins forward of the center fin and they had it on the back. Neither of us knew that the other one was doing anything until that article came out. Mm. And so they did a few and then that was it. They sort of left the idea on the shelf.
Probably because the boards, I mean, if the board works, you pursue the idea, right? So I would imagine the board might not perform that well.
Well, Reno, I mean, the boards, Reno has said that Duncan knows Reno very well, my brother, and he knows Reno really well and has had long conversations about that with Reno. Because Reno's, you know, he's got some bonzers, some of our bonzers these days, or actually for quite a few years, and has made some himself. And so he and Duncan always have, you know, a lot of conversations
yeah.
about stuff. And they just didn't, you know, the boards had good, their boards had good characteristics. They just didn't stick with it.
Okay.
And on the other hand, what we found after riding that first one, and you know, I've told this story lots of times, but the first time we took out the bonzer, the first bonzer that we made, the first turn, even with our limited surfing experience, the first turn, you could tell right away that this was really something of value. And I know it sounds silly, but it's not an exaggeration. Mm. Like I said, you know, there's a backside, you know, it was a left, and I surfed backside. And the first bottom turn, compared to the single fins and twin fins we were riding, it was just a quantum difference.
In what way?
In terms of speed and control.
Okay.
Because this is a very wide tail board,
mm-hmm.
and you could tell right away that you had the speed that you'd get out of the wide tail board. But you would have the control on, you know, with the bottom, you know, with bottom turns, and edge control was the
sure.
biggest thing, because that what was lacking in wide tail twin fins and single fins was that edge control. So immediately, because of the long profile side fin runner, you would really amplify the ability to use your edges in mm-hmm. turns on a short wide board. So you were getting drive, speed, and carry out of the fins, and then the maneuverability out of the board being so short.
Right.
So we knew right away that we had something, and then it was pretty much from that day on, okay, what are we going to do with this?
Right.
And so what that involved was learning to surf better, obviously, but educating ourselves as far as just making surfboards.
I'm interested in the relationship that exists for shapers and board designers, that is the testing process. I think for a lot of other people who deal with hydrodynamics outside of surfing, they can take things into a laboratory environment probably. And a lot of that testing is not based on their own ability, you know, their surfing ability. So I'm curious what the limitations are in that relationship. You know, like you said, we learned to become better surfers while we were learning about the hydrodynamic mm-hmm. principles, and those things probably went hand in hand. But I guess I'm just kind of curious about what the limitations are of that. And I suppose at a certain point you rely on other surfers to give feedback, and what, you know, how does that work? And are there limitations?
That's a good observation. And basically I would say that maybe the development of the Bonzer initially was a tad slower than it could have been if we were already accomplished surfers. But we also had the advantage of living in an area where there wasn't a lot of peer pressure for anything. This is basically the hinterlands of Southern California surfing. And it was, you know, kind of the Wild West in a way. Mm-hmm. And so we were learning to surf and build surfboards simultaneously in terms of, you know, developing our abilities in both simultaneously. And with the access to good surf and, you know, lack of crowds and so forth, that was a nice advantage to have.
Sure.
I think they fed each other, because the Bonzer enabled us to surf better more quickly than we would have learned without the Bonzer.
Interesting.
I look at old photos from that Craig Feynman and some of our old, you know, other photos back from, say, 1973, which is the year we took the design to Bing. By 1972, 73, we were surfing pretty well.
Okay.
And so our learning curve, like I say, I'm sure it was much faster because of the Bonzer.
What are the other design elements? We talk about three fins and those two side fins being keel-shaped. What are the other design elements in concert with those fins that make up a Bonzer?
Well, the first year shaping the Bonzers, we basically just had a normal bottom. It was, you know, flat up forward with some V going through the tail area and the fins and the fin area. So we just had basically it was a slight V bottom three fin.
Okay.
The second year in 72, we started putting a single to double concave on the board. So there was single concave forward of the fins, and then going through the fin area, it turned to a double concave with a little bit of V.
And that was something that other board builders were doing as well?
No.
No.
Maybe somebody out there like somewhere.
Sure.
But in terms of the single to double concave, I haven't seen any evidences of it.
Oh, okay.
Maybe somebody can drag something up. But,
sure.
But so it was a single to double concave with slight V through the fin area and the three fins. And that's really what comprises essentially still the Bonzer today. And the single to double concave concept has, you know, become standard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously different shape, you know, different shape fins than ours. And,
yeah.
You know, when Simon did his fins and that evolved. But the single to double concave bottom has really become the standard for high performance surfboards.
Yeah.
So I, you know, we came up with a three fin board with single and double concave, and that was, I think, I don't know the best way to describe it. I still think that I think that it's probably the most comprehensively original design.
Yeah.
Functional design.
Right.
Definitely in the history of shortboards, but I know it's, but maybe in surfboards.
Sure.
And I'm not, you know, I don't like to, you know, grandstand or anything, but with something, the basic idea that we came up with that many years ago is still, you know, cutting edge.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any other way to,
yeah,
to put it.
We talk about the bottom. That is what defines the bonzer. Is there anything in terms of outline that defines the bonzer, or length? Can a bonzer be a 5 foot board and a 10 foot board?
Yes.
Got it.
And that's one of the unique things about the bonzer, is that it's a system.
Mm.
It's a system more than a surfboard.
Mm.
Because the combination of the three, originally the three fin with the single, the double concave, and then in 83 we did a 5 fin version. We began doing the 5 fin version again with the same single to double concave, and the bottom's changed. It's mellowed over the years. I mean, the early ones were extremely deep, and
I've seen a couple photos. Yeah,
extremely deep and everything. But you know, it's just you evolve from, you know, over the years and refine things. But it is more of a system than it is a surfboard. The bonzer works on sailboards. It works on knee boards. It works on long boards. It works on, you know, any kind of shortboard. And that's one of the really interesting things that we found over the years, is that it basically can be used on anything.
Right.
So you just need to make the proper board for the proper board for the proper conditions and make it a bonzer.
I think that's an important point. And a reason why I'm glad to be having the conversation with you is because prior to really researching, having this conversation, my awareness of the bonzer seemed something else, not a novelty, but just there's longboards and there's fish and there's a bonzer, and all the footage and media that I see related to it almost has a novelty act feel. They'll make a video section and put a cheeky song and make the footage black and white and grainy to make it look different and old school. And the realization that I've come to is that's really kind of a disservice to the bonzer, and that it's like a vehicle. You can have a hybrid in a car or a truck or a van. The hybrid is the bonzer. You know, it applies to anything. It's not strictly limited to a design, a vehicle design.
You know? Yeah. Well, I mean, we're going into we're in the 45th year here of this project.
Yeah.
And it's run the gamut from, at first, the criticisms have come from all, you know, many different directions. Not necessarily all, some criticisms and some, a lot of pigeonholing.
Yeah.
I mean, we grew up surfing in this area. The original footage, or still footage, was, you know, Craig Fineman and stuff in Surfer Magazine and Surfing. So invariably, it was in good surf.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're surfing Silver Strand, the waves are hollow,
right,
and whatnot. So for years, the boards were sort of pigeonholed as they only work in good surf.
Right, right, right.
And that was just de facto. That was where we were surfing the waves. We weren't always surfing good waves, but the only pictures that are going to get in a magazine are pictures of people surfing good waves.
Right.
No one cares about somebody surfing a 2 feet. 2 foot, you know,
yeah.
2 foot slop. And so the boards always worked in all conditions. Again, you just had to make the proper board for the right condition. And it's a very complex, it's far too much to get into in terms of sort of the evolution of perception of the bonzer,
mm-hmm.
in comparison to reality. Sure. I mean, if you look at, there's a picture that maybe a lot of the people have seen. It went viral over this couple of times within the last few months, of Taylor Knox doing a cutback at Velzyland with all five of his fins showing. It was a water shot. And, you know, that's on a 6'1 contemporary shortboard shape. Mm-hmm. The bonds are, we're kind of in an interesting position because we've been around so long that, and the design's been around so long that, yes, you can get pigeonholed in terms sure. of retro, and a lot of the younger, well, whatever you want to say, younger people experimenting with old designs and so forth. And
yeah.
So that's helped us because people have opened their minds and so they've gotten on the boards. But also we've tried to avoid getting lumped in with the whole retro crowd because we make plenty of high performance shortboards for a lot of extremely good surfers. Many have them, but
yeah,
they just ride them recreationally because they ride for other people. Sure. And,
yeah, it's nice to get the benefit of that retro movement. It's just a shame that they're viewing it as a retro thing, you know, because it isn't.
Yeah, I think it's softening a little bit.
I agree.
Totally. I think that idea is softening a little bit. The internet helps a lot with that. A big change came for us when Surfers Journal did the article on us back, and I think it was 2004, mm-hmm. and when Steve Berlotti, when he wrote the article, we just that was the only stipulation that we had, is that we want to make sure that we bring out the fact that we're still making contemporary yeah. high performance surfboards, and that the Bonzer isn't retro, and in fact never was.
Well, to elaborate on that image of Taylor Knox that you're talking about, I mean, that was a very high performance turn. That turn, it's like he is full rail Taylor Knox at his finest, like high performance surfing on that board.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful photo.
Yeah, and the thing about that photo is that you can't see what happened afterwards, but he didn't spin out.
Right.
That carried through.
Right.
And you know, that was one of the main, you know, design characteristics that we learned from the Bonzer, was being able to know, have extreme maneuvers with, and still being able to carry the speed through the maneuver.
Mm. Where did the name Bonzer come from?
It's an Australian slang word meaning extraordinary or unique. It's an adjective. It's, you know, and my dad ran across it again. You know, my dad happened to accidentally ran across it in an Oxford English Dictionary, and we were so enamored by what was going on with the Australian surf scene, and he happened to find that Australian word, and we just said, that's it, you know?
I wonder what the genesis of the word is for in Australia. You know, like
it's been around a long time. I mean, I think even in the 1800s, it was used. I know that there was a series on years and years ago called The Thornbirds. It was like a, you know, TV miniseries.
Yeah.
It was Australian families and outback, and I think it was. I forget what years it was in, but I think it was maybe late 1800s, early 1900s that it was going on. It may have been in the 20s, maybe up to the 20s or
yeah.
But we actually heard when they were describing, someone had a baby and someone used it. They said, that's a Bonzer, you know, little baby, a Bonzer baby. You know, it's the only time I've ever heard it actually used in context.
I'm interested, a lot of your initial designs came from understanding the hydrodynamics of boats, as you said. What's unique about the hydrodynamic principles applied to surfing as opposed to all other watercraft?
I think it's where the energy comes from. Because, you know, you have if it's a sailboat, you have, you know, wind providing the energy to move you forward. A motorboat, obviously, you have external sort of power source. Constant power source. So that's what's unique about surfboards, is that you're utilizing the energy that exists within the wave. And then obviously you yourself are applying force at different points, at the applying force and putting energy. That's the additional energy to help drive the board. Drive the board forward, but you are utilizing. You're trying to utilize the wave, the energy that exists within the wave, and that's constantly changing. The surface is constantly changing its shape, whether it's going from hollow to mushy or whatever. Right. So, in a sense, surfboards need to be somewhat generalized in a way. You can't make it too specific. You can make a board that'll go really fast.
Right.
That's easy.
Sure.
But it's not going to turn.
Right.
So the idea is to, our idea always was to make something that is really versatile and that can utilize the energy that is created by the water passing underneath, by the water that's passing underneath, you know, the board. And so using the concaves to organize the concaves and the side fins, because the angle on the side fins sort of match and fade into the concaves.
Right.
So the fins, in a sense, are an extension of the concaves. And so what we were trying to do was organize the water flow to move more efficiently underneath the board. And picturing what's happening when you're doing a bottom turn is the water's coming across the bottom of your board diagonally. So when you have that long side fin, now they're, you know, 9 3/4 on the three fin, and on the five fin, the same amount of base, but with the two side fins. So you've got 9 3/4 inches of base on your fin. So the inside rail, you're having all getting all that edge control, and the fins are angled out more, canted out more than any other fins, thrusters, or twin fins or anything. So when you do a bottom turn, your inside fins are fairly vertical in the water, which gives you very nice edge control. And then the outside fins, having that 9 3/4 inches of base, that water that's coming diagonally across the bottom of the board doesn't just escape off the outside rail as unused energy. So what happens is it gets deflected down and back through the tail, which is really what helps give you a lot more of that forward momentum.
Right.
And the fins being low profile, they, you know, can exit and enter the water very easily.
Sure.
So you're just trying to, the idea was just to utilize as much of the existing energy that's made available.
Talking about pioneering some of these design aspects outside of the surf industry, people patent ideas to basically benefit their business, essentially. Is there ever any thought of that for you guys? And if there was, did you have an interest in doing it? What are your thoughts on that concept? I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
What I've seen now, though, in modern times is like Elon Musk, you know, with Tesla, does these open source patents where his concept is there's a greater good than just my personal business. And I think that we can expand the world market of electric vehicles if everybody's working on this idea.
So. Right. Well, yeah, that's good. Yeah, that's a good point. With my dad, my dad was involved. I mean, there was a short split second, in a sense, of thinking about, well, do you patent something like this or what? But Duncan and I, from the get-go, once we happened on and designed and refined the Bonzer to the point of where we really knew. This was within 2 years. We knew that this was something that to be reckoned with, and we wanted to contribute to the development of surfboards, more so than anything else, and contribute to surfing. And that was, and in order to do that, that was the reason that we went to Bing. Well, we put out letters to a lot of companies, but Bing was the only one that responded. It's because we wanted to get the idea out. And so the only thing we've done that way is, you know, we've copyrighted the name Bonser.
Okay.
Because we just wanted to have that name identification to the design and have that be ours. And, but in terms of the design, basically our attitude became very quickly, you know, it's copyright for the world.
Okay.
I mean, that was our attitude.
When you're hiring for a small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role, and there's no faster or effective way than through LinkedIn Jobs. Your time and capital are precious, and there is a powerful resource that can help you focus on what you're good at and integrate people into your team seamlessly to help grow your business. LinkedIn Jobs has created the tools to find the right professionals for your team efficiently and for free. LinkedIn isn't just another job board. Everyone is already on LinkedIn with their resumes and references, and now LinkedIn has designed a hiring platform to connect you with candidates specifically qualified for the job that you post about. More than a billion professionals meticulously organized to connect people by skill set to help us all advance our position. 2.5 million businesses already use LinkedIn for hiring, and 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. It's that fast, easy to use, and effective. LinkedIn Jobs can help you write job descriptions, filter the right person to you, and give you the tools to help you interview them like a pro. LinkedInJobs.com/surf is where you go to post your job for free. Yes, totally free. That's linkedinjobs.com/surf to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply.
To add contextual history for listener, like Bing was an important surfboard builder at that time. So you thought, we've got this idea and we're not going to be able to build boards on the level that Bing does, but perhaps they can take it and bring it to the masses who would then benefit from the design.
Yeah. Well, we figured we learned real quickly that just from the reaction locally, you know, we were scoffed at to say the least, but, and we figured the only way we were going to get this design out was to have a reputable manufacturer do it. We sent out, like I said, we sent out a few things. We sent help out to Weber and Jacobs and I forget who else, but Bing. And Bing was the only one that responded. And so, and Bing was really one of the top, if not, you know, top, you know, board builders at the time. And so, and Bing and Mike Eaton, Mike was, you know, Bing's main shaper. So
sure.
Those two guys were shaping the boards. And we figured it was really going to be the only way to get it out is to get a big name behind it.
Yeah.
So we took our garage shaped and glassed boards, which were pretty darn crude at that time in 73. And we had started taking Super 8 films already. So we had some Super 8 film and our boards, and, you know, Bing got back to us very quickly. And when we contacted them and we went down there, and we showed them our little Super 8 movies and our embarrassingly crude glass jobs and so forth and shapes. And they were, you know, they could see from the film that the boards worked.
Sure.
And they looking at, so as well as the boards were working in the film and then looking at the crude, you know, handiwork, I think that probably added to a little bit of head scratching and go, well, you know, maybe we ought to check this out.
Okay.
And they were very gracious about the whole thing, being such a nice guy, and Mike as well. And they just said, well, let's make a few. We'll have our team writers try them out. And if they think they work, we'll give it a go. And they had a really good team. I mean, Drew Harrison, Tiger Macon, Bacon Brothers, Jim Neese, I know Mike Stevenson. So they had a lot of really top Southern California surfers. Mm. So they made a couple. I shaped the bottom in the first couple that they made.
Okay.
Mike shaped and Bing shaped the boards. And the word came back that they worked.
Good.
And so Bing, they basically put together a full-on ad campaign. And when you look back, I mean, I look back at it and I just go, man, this was amazing. I mean, they put, you know, we got, because it was Bing, we got articles in Surfer and Surfing Magazine. And that pretty much, you know, it launched it in terms of some visibility.
Yeah.
And they did quite a few for a couple of years, and we stayed with them for a little over a year. And then Bing sold, actually not sold, but licensed his licensed Bing to Gordon Smith. And so they moved down. So when all the licensing went through, they moved down to San Diego, and that was a lot farther for us to go than Hermosa Beach. And,
yeah.
And things didn't really work out that well. Mike was down working with him, and that was still great because Mike's an unreal guy. But it just didn't work out too good for us. So we didn't like the way things were going, and we just bailed.
Okay.
And went back and started building, came up and started building boards up here.
In the 70s, I know PT was riding Bonzers in Australia, mm-hmm. and probably around the world to, you know, success. Were they shaped by you guys or Bang or?
No, actually PT made those.
And oh, he did. Okay.
What we, Duncan just recently, it's neat. A lot of artifacts are starting to show up.
Okay, cool.
PT is a notorious record keeper, I've learned. And he has a handwritten note and diagram from Mike Eaton. Mike sent PT a little diagram and a note about showing the Bonzer. And Duncan,
like the design file, basically.
He basically had a little hand drawn thing about the Bonzer and the fins, and you know, a note on it about these things really work. You might want to try it out.
Wow.
And PT gave it a go, and lately we've learned over the last really 5 years only, we've learned how much more Bonzer activity was going on down there than we ever knew
down there in Australia.
Yeah, in Australia,
right.
And PT and some other guys, and then Terry Richardson made and wrote some Bonzers, and quite a few other guys. And PT actually won. I think he won a Newcastle contest on, which was a big contest back then on a Bonzer. And it's been gratifying to kind of know how much went on down there before. I mean that we didn't even know about.
Right. How has the design developed since the 70s? I know that at some point you introduced five fins, two additional fins. Mm-hmm. What was that leap? And
the main changes have been in 83 we did the five fin, which is really the exact same principle, except for that the easiest way to picture it is we took the front. Little less than half of the original long fin and moved it out to the more toward the rail.
Okay.
So you've still got the same amount of base, but, and then we obviously changed the shape. We changed the shape of the fins and so forth. And so there's a little more fin area on the five fin than the three fin, but it puts some of that fin area more out toward the rail.
For
so
added control, essentially.
So basically it gave the boards a different riding characteristic in terms of, probably quickness and ability to push the tail, push the tail around a little bit more. And basically it fit more the way surfing was developing, the approach.
A certain amount of maybe like release or looseness with the control?
Yeah, it's a little bit quicker. I think quicker is probably the more of the operative word than loose. But yeah, I could say loose and quicker. Quicker off the top, a little more pivoty, able to pivot off the top more quickly and control the control of the tail in tighter situations on a wave, in the hook and so forth.
Because you do see certainly the professional modern surfers releasing the tail, but with a great amount of control, you know.
They have control because they're so darn good.
Of course, yeah.
Because when you do watch, that's one of the big differences, is a sidebar in a sense, but one of the biggest differences between a Bonzer and a thruster, normal tri-fin, is that with thrusters, you do lose, the tail will come loose, you know, much more easily than on a Bonzer. In terms of loose, I mean, spinning out, or not so much spinning out, but getting sideways drift and loss of, in a sense, loss of momentum. Mm. But the guys are so good that actually that what we saw as the slight deficiency design-wise actually became something that was really incorporated into the repertoire and style and of surfing.
Right.
Because, you know, approach and the surfing approach obviously is tied to design characteristics of the surfboards. So,
right.
Again, that's a different discussion.
But. Well, I'm curious about that actually. Do you follow professional surfing at all, or competitive surfing, really?
No, not that much. I mean, obviously, I look and see what, you know, I always see what guys are doing in terms of how they're surfing and so forth.
Well, my question is related to that and the point that you just made, which is, I wonder how much professional competitive surfing drives design or inhibits design. You know, because I feel like a lot of the areas we've gone down in design that have proven to not be that beneficial were driven by competitive surfing. Like in the 90s, really thin potato chip boards with a tremendous amount of rocker, you know, like that sort of thing. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that, you know, professional competitive surfing either driving or inhibiting.
Well, it cuts both ways.
Okay.
I mean to take the political answer, but it does cut.
But you're right.
It does cut both ways in the sense it does slow design down in some ways, but that's mainly because I think that a lot of shapers over the years become more influenced by the surfers, by the riders, rather than maybe. Sticking with some of would differ with different individuals
or but experimentation
because the guys these guys have just been in such incredible surfers,
right?
And so they'll find something that goes good for them,
right?
And then the shaper says, "Oh, okay," and then they'll build that, and then through transference of media and so forth, then Kelly's writing this or Taylor's writing that or Rob's, you know, whoever. That starts to drive design in a particular direction.
Yeah.
Some of that works for the benefit of pushing design forward, and then some of it can slow, you know, it can slow things down because people are trying to sell boards. And you want to sell, you want to make stuff that's going to sell.
Yeah.
And
the quandary in my mind, I think, is that, like, ultimately it comes down to the judges giving a score on a wave that dictates who's winning these world titles or whatever. And if those judges have a predefined criteria, then they're really setting the ultimate bar that you're trying to achieve. Now the surfer's trying to hit those targets. So he's requiring something of the shaper in order for him to hit that target, which really limits creativity on the shaper's behalf. I feel like the best evolutions that we've made come from this creative expression via the shaper, and then you pursue these paths. The other example I just gave is the exact opposite. It's like a trickle down from the judges rather than a trickle up from the shaper, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that professional tour gives great visibility to showcase the quality of these designs, but there's also danger in that, I guess, is my thought.
Well, yeah, again, it's both things happening simultaneously.
Yeah.
The narrower, thinner boards allowed people to utilize different parts of the wave,
right?
Literally get into certain types of waves that are extremely hollow and pitching out and so forth that were much more difficult to be able to get into and to maneuver properly with, you know, a board with bulkier rails or right. or more volume. It just, you know, sort of went to the extreme. It went to the extreme. So on the one hand, it showed, it opened up a new new possibilities in terms of wave riding.
Right.
But the extreme to the, that the boards went to made it more difficult for average guys to surf well.
Right. Exactly.
So in the rarefied atmosphere of this extreme talent, it was beneficial.
Sure.
And it opened shapers and opened other surfers' minds to being able to ride waves in ride different parts of the wave more functionally or at all.
Right.
I mean, I remember a quote from Duncan back in when Kelly was, I don't know, he was a few years on to the North Shore. And Duncan, because we're always looking at, we were looking at the five late 80s, early 90s and so forth is what are we going to do with the five fin? Because we had set it aside. We did it in 83 okay. and it worked great, but the thruster was coming on super strong and it was going to, and it was a good design. And so, it, you know, it was yeah. going to happen. So there was no sense in us trying to, you know, buck the tidal wave that sure. was coming along. So we rode them, made them for our friends. The reason I mention this is because when Kelly really came on and made his presence really felt on the North Shore, I remember Duncan saying to me that in watching Kelly sometimes, it was like he was manipulating matter. Because where he was going and what he was doing on the waves perceptually was you just didn't think
in those terms.
You didn't think in those terms and that this was going to happen. And partly that was because of his equipment and partly because of his extreme talent. So for us, and so we just said, that's it. We're the five fin, we were thinking, okay, we're still going to be buried for quite some time, because with this quantum change in performance
yeah.
of surfing, this thruster design is going to be strong right. and move on for quite some time. So again, it works both ways. We
yeah.
we feel that we had a competitive, not only a competitive, more than competitive design, but we weren't going to be able to compete in that arena,
right?
Because you had the high levels of talent, professional surfing, media, and everything else
sure.
was going in this direction.
Sure.
So
interesting.
It goes both ways. It works both ways.
What are the limitations of the Bonzer design?
I don't believe they've been reached yet. We don't know, and. You can only, people go, why don't you do something different? Well, yeah, I can do something different. We can do something different, but what's the point? Mm-hmm. We haven't reached, because inefficiency is what drives evolution.
Mm.
So you need to find the deficiencies and shortcomings of stuff before you can, you know, before you can improve it, because that's what gives you the map. That gives you the map in order to
right.
for future design. So we've been fortunate over the last 10, 15 years to have more top surfers ride the boards for a bit, push the boards farther than obviously we ever did or ever can.
Yeah.
You know, I'm 63 now. I'm not pushing... You know, I'm not pushing design right. forward with my surfing abilities anymore. So you do need the top, you know, the top level mm-hmm. surfers to get on your equipment and push it as much as possible. In the last 10 years, we've had a lot more top guys, you know, guys of really high level experience, ride and talent to ride the boards and push the design. And that's, you know, that's really. For us, it's not that part of it's not even commercial in a sense, because I mean it helps every once in a while a picture of somebody will show up riding the boards, but those guys, most of the guys have, you know, they have board sponsors and so forth, and they ride the boards recreationally. But for us, it's good because we can see guys with extremely high levels of surfing go out and ride the boards. And basically, our attitude is trial by fire. Go for it. See, if you can outsurf this board, and you can, mm-hmm. you can outsurf this design, I should say, not necessarily the board, because obviously, you know, board's a matter of fine-tuning for sure. the individual. But if you can outsurf this design and find the deficiencies, we're glad to hear it.
Well, I saw Mick Fanning riding one of your boards the year that he won the world title. The last year he won the world title, which I think was 2 years ago. So I'm riding one of your boards on the North Shore. Obviously that Taylor Knox stuff. And I've seen him riding it in Mexico as well, that footage, which is really impressive. I've seen Joel Tudor riding your boards. What feedback do you receive from those guys? Do they actually, I mean, you're talking about go ahead and try to, you know, best the design, but do you receive feedback directly from them?
Oh, yeah, yeah. A lot of the guys will let us know if the boards work and how they work.
What have you heard?
Well, what we hear is the boards work unreal. And then you think, okay, so take the next step. But that's really where we're at.
Okay.
That next step of seriously committing to putting consistent time in on the boards at that level of hasn't materialized yet. And that's something that, because I mean, Duncan's got a list of people that, you know, makes your ears bleed, of guys that have ridden the boards and the feedback they, you know, they give, you know, right? Because he's on the North Shore, and so a lot of the guys will stumble into the shop and over there next to the restaurant, the Bonzer Front, and try a board here, try a board there. And, you know, there's just an incredible amount of really talented guys that ride the boards. And I mean, I'm not trying to exaggerate or anything, but every single one of them has a good go on the boards. And not only a good go, they're really surprised initially how well they work. I mean, Taylor's been riding the boards on and off, you know, I mean, just sporadically, I mean, for 16 years.
Okay.
And Joel just you know, did a little post on Instagram to a picture, this thing I put up of some of the Rush Short models. Joel's, we made 15, you know, almost 15 years ago, we made Joel, you know, a three fin bonzer and a five fin. He got a five fin egg back then. And so he's been riding, you know, so a lot of these guys, there's some incredible footage of Rob riding one and Rob Machado riding one and some lefts in Chile. And to a person, they love the way the boards work. And they could ease, you know, but everybody's doing their different thing. I mean, either you have a board sponsor or you're onto your own, you know, you kind of, you know, your own thing. And
are there, so, what are the what's the stumbling block between to take that next step? I mean, or do you have any interest in being a board sponsor and supplying somebody who is on that top level with a quiver of boards throughout the year?
Well, for one thing, economically, it's just impossible.
Well, let's talk about that.
So that's something we couldn't do. And in terms of, like I mentioned before, for us having these guys ride the boards, in a sense, now it's become sort of almost a, it's sort of an academic pursuit in the sense of learning and seeing, okay, you guys, you know, ride the boards, let's see how it goes. And again, like I say, we're up for, you know, criticism, suggestions or whatever. So in that sense, it's personal vindication in the sense of here's designs we've been working on for well, what's 83, that, you know, for the five fin, and 1970 for the three fin, to see something that's been around 45 years and see guys go out and surf to their potential. A recent example of that is there's some recent footage that showed up, different things of Alex Nose riding a three fin bonzer. not much different than a board we did in 1973.
Okay.
And he can go out and surf to the top of his ability in 2015 on a board, on a design that is, you know, 42 years old.
Right.
To us, that's what it's all about.
Yeah.
Personally. Obviously I make my living shaping. We got to, you know,
right.
Got to make a few bucks. But at this point, we've sort of realized the space that we were inhabiting and settled in on the idea of sharing the design both with shapers, other shapers, and, you know, with surfers, and trying to when we had the opportunity to have top guys get on and try the boards and ride them, you know, even if it's just a couple times a year, yeah, recreationally or whatever, and,
right,
and benefit, you know, and sort of benefit with that, and keep pushing things forward that way. And in all seriousness, the last year and a half since I, you know, we met Alex a year and a half ago, and he's put more time on Bonzers than, you know, a mm-hmm. lot of the, than, you know, most of the kind of top level guys that
yeah.
have been riding them. I mean, Taylor's been riding them on and off for a lot of years, and Alex has put a lot of time in the last year and a half and learned
good.
About them and riding them, and that's been, you good. Know, it's been interesting because this really was sort of out of left field.
Sure.
Because I'm pretty much hunkered down and to myself. Duncan sees more people in Hawaii, but
yeah.
But well, he approached us, and you know, it was interesting.
I'm glad to hear that because he is an incredible surfer, and I've seen him surf a lot around, you know, where I live and surf for a long time. And I feel like he's done himself a disservice at times riding boards that limit his ability. His ability is so great, and he rides these old, outdated, archaic designs that never worked that well when they got introduced. Mm-hmm. And he's probably got reasons why he's riding those, but I'm glad to see that he's on functional equipment, you know? Because I've seen some of the footage you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the interesting thing about that was, I mean, you know, Alex, he's definitely an interesting cat, and he, you know, the degree of difficulty is raised on a lot of the equipment he rides, and he still surfs the stuff really well.
Totally.
Getting on the Bonzer, what we're surmising, and it's allowed him to ride this more that kind of style of board, wide point forward,
right,
70s-ish type style of a board. But with the Bonzer, with the increased performance that the Bonzer gives any shape, it allows him to ride that style of board and do the things that he likes to do much easier.
Right.
And more efficiently.
Yeah. That's
and
a good
that's
point.
Kind of the difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that board design has been somewhat stymied by certain things, but one of the things that you mentioned, which is just profitability, like it's a low profit thing. Are there any limitations that you see to board design currently?
I would say thinking is what's mostly slowed board design for many years. And part of that is financial, but because you need to make enough boards to survive and so forth. And the Bonzers were always more difficult to produce. And so some people didn't want to hassle with glassing on all those fins and so forth. So that kept some, you know, that kept some people from wanting to make Bonzers and maybe other things.
Right.
But I just really think that a lot of it has to do with, it just has to do with a lack of creativity. And there is a lot of creativity, you know, creative people,
right,
in the surfboard industry, incredible shapers, incredible craftsmen, but
who among them are undervalued, do you think, as a pioneer of a design that's been undervalued, whose work currently exists that you think is kind of being overlooked?
That's hard for me to say because I don't know because I know a lot of guys are doing really good work. It's embarrassing to even say, but I really kind of just, I don't pay much attention to what, I see really nice boards by a lot of people.
Sure.
I mean, you know, you can, the list is, if I name a few, I'm going to
leave out a few,
but suffice to say that there's a lot of really incredible shaping going on in terms of quality, you know, craftsmanship, from long boards to short boards, alternative boards. I mean, the old guys, some newer guy, you know, some relatively newer guys, and there's just beautiful. And now with all the great glassing and stuff, there's a lot of beautiful surfboards being made. Most of those surfboards, though, design-wise, it's all derivative of, you know, past stuff, and even duplicating, you know, past things. But I've taken the position really for quite some time of just, I don't go to surfboard sites. I pretty much am just focused on, you know, on what improving what I do in terms of shaping. And obviously, you know, influences, you know, come through, and someone will ask me, I'd really like a board, but can we do this, you know, this tail shape on it or that tail shape on it? And if I need to, you know, check out what they're referencing, you know, then I'll do that and incorporate it. I mean, we're in no way, shape or form do we have any reticence to incorporate things that are functional that other people have done in terms of template shape and so forth. But obviously we stick with, you know, doing the Bonzers, and we've been maniacally focused on that for, you know, now 45 years. So,
do you ride anybody else's surfboards?
It's if I trade with somebody in the water or something, but,
Are there any projects or design experiments that you're currently working on?
You know, we've done a little more variety of templates, different template shapes in the last few years, surely because people have asked for it. I mean, because before we were always into short, wide boards, but for years people weren't really riding short, wide boards. So we don't tend to make things just for the sake of making them.
Sure.
It's really more, you know, a form follows function, issue with us. And so we don't do, you know, it can look a little bit stale and stagnant maybe from the outside, because we don't add specifically come up with like new models and names of things every year. We do a lot of custom boards in between, but you're making boards that are, but if we do a custom board for somebody, we don't say, turn it into a model,
right,
and this and that. So we've kept our model range relatively small, but then within that, between mixing and matching with those and incorporating, you know, template shapes that other people might be doing, and a customer says, hey, I want to try this. I really like the looks of this shape, but, you know, I'd like to try it as a Bonzer. Okay, you know, let's do it.
Yeah. Your logo advises to be mindful. Can you talk about that?
That logo we came up with in the 70s. I think that logo was probably from about 76 or so, 70. Well, yeah, 75, 76. And it was during a time when we were expanding our ideas and thoughts about various things philosophically, spiritually, and whatnot. And mindfulness obviously comes out of the Buddhist tradition. Ours, we put an extra L on there. It says mindful. It's not spelled properly, but it's a little bit of a, you know, sort of a, you know, just a double meaning in the sense there of. But yeah, it came out of our, and it has the pyramid and the triangle and the pyramid in the center and that. And, you know, that had to do with a lot of, you know, things we were learning about and studying and sort of that old, not to coin a phrase, but consciousness expansion movement back then. And, mm-hmm. And so we've always tried to incorporate, and along with the Be Mindful logo, and then we've signed, you know, peace on all of our every board since, you know, I don't know, the first year we did that was probably in, you know, sometime around 72 or 73, just signed peace over the serial number of the board. And so we've just really tried to incorporate, you know, our, in some small way, you know, keep there from being any separation between our basic, you know, philosophical ideas about things and our, yeah, you know, and our surfboards.
Over those years, what has changed for you philosophically and what has not wavered at all philosophically?
We probably haven't really changed that much. Obviously, you know, your knowledge base increases.
Yeah.
But we've really tried to bring forward what we learned when we were younger during that time of, you know, whatever, late 60s into the, you know, mid 70s of, you know, sort of the whatever you want to call it, was sort of more toward the tail end of the counterculture movement, but you know, through the experimentation with psychedelics and so forth, and the positive side that came out of that in terms of expanding ways of thinking and approaching, you know, approaching problems, and obviously not the abuse of that, which, you know, happened as well, but to try to bring the good things that try to bring what good we learned and from those times, and you know, it was the end of the, you know, tail end of the heavy parts of the civil rights movement, and then the anti-war movement, and the peace movement, and the beginnings of the environmental movement, and all that stuff, good stuff was happening. And so in this day and age, when people sort of treat the 60s very tritely and condescending, the 60s and early 70s in a condescending manner, we really have tried to bring all the good that we learned through that time, mm-hmm, forward and not run away from it. Mm. You know, a lot of people that I know, my peers and contemporaries, you know, people, they buckled down, they got their, you know, got their 9-to-5s, raised a family, and in a lot of ways, many, many people, and I think that's one of the problems we have politically these days, is people in my generation, they basically walked away from a lot of the ethos that, right, the positive side of the ethos that developed back then. And I think it's led to, you know, a very problematic drift in society, not only environmentally, but politically and, you know, just justice-wise, you know, justice-wise and everything else. So we've tried to bring forward what we did learn, and as well as continue to,
that's nice,
continue to expand our awareness.
There's a theme in things that we've talked about here. I mean, talking about psychedelics, and then that professional competitive expression of the potato chip surfboard, and then even talking about your concaves as an example, where you have to almost go out to a distant extreme when experimenting with something, but inevitably the answer is the more refined version of that. Like, mm-hmm, when experimenting, you got to go out and just try the most extreme version to see how it works. And then you realize the benefit and the negative of it. And then you scale back, refine it. And that, mm-hmm, becomes the model. You know?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of a natural, you know, it's sort of a natural evolution of things. And, you know, again, time plays a part in that, because what seems extreme at one point, you know, gradually over time,
right,
you know, may not cease be so extreme. I mean, with ours, you know, it's like, well, an airplane. I mean, yeah, it seemed extreme at first, you know, the basic physics and aerodynamics and so forth that allowed a plane to fly, you know, that all remained the same. Mm-hmm. It obviously remains the same, but again, like you say, you know, refinement you know, refinement and design comes right. over time and development of technology. Right. And I mean, there are certain things that you can, that are extreme ideas that you can't produce at right. a certain point in time, say Da Vinci or whoever, you know, there was a lot of great ideas and flying machines and so forth, but without the, you know, they were theorized, but without the technical ability and materials sure. To build those designs and actualize the design principles,
right.
You know, it takes time.
What's your current relationship like with surfing? I mean, how often do you surf?
Oh, not enough. Between work and whatever, injuries or this or that, not injuries, but yeah, injuries or whatnot, different things. You know, I'm not surfing quite enough, but trying to surf more again because time's moving on and I want to try to surf as much, you know,
yeah,
as much as we can. Duncan still surfs a lot in Hawaii.
Yeah.
So, in terms of relationship with surfing, I mean, whether I'm surfing or not, you're making a surfboard. And so you're constantly mm-hmm. thinking about surfing mm-hmm. because what you're making has to, you know, it has to work. Yeah. It has to, somebody has some ideas they want to board. You're translating their ideas into a functional piece of equipment to work. And so you're always visualizing, you're always, you know, so even though I'm not in the water, you're still thinking a lot about it.
The brand is Campbell Brothers. Mm-hmm. What is that relationship like from a business standpoint? If somebody orders a board, who's making it and all that?
I'm shaping it, except for just lately, my son Jacob, who's living in Hawaii. I have twin sons. Ian lives in Los Angeles, and Jacob's in Hawaii, living over near Duncan, and he's actually doing, you know, shaping some boards now over there. And you know, we've got, you know, with the advent of the, obviously with the shaping machines and whatnot, you know, we can have the files, you know, and have the boards cut over there. And Jacob's very good at doing the concaves and finishing everything out. And so he's been doing a few boards. Cool. And as far as Campbell Brothers, yeah, it's Duncan and I. Duncan stopped shaping, except for, he would shape a board every now and again. But he stopped shaping, you know, at a consistent basis back in, you know, say 1976. And then he's done boards now and again. But I pretty much made all the boards. And,
right.
Like I say, now Jacob's doing a few, and you know, we use the shaping machine somewhat. Depends how busy I am.
Sure.
You know, I'll still hand shape 60, depending on how busy we are, but I'll hand shape 60% of the boards. But
sure.
The concaves, every concave on every bonzer is hand shaped because
oh, yeah.
the machines don't cut the bonzer concaves in. Those programs don't do that. But yeah, so Duncan and I mean, it's always been really close. He's been living in the North Shore since 82.
Right.
And but you know, we have super close relationship, and without him, actually him being in Hawaii and surfing the North Shore all those years and having contact with you know, the scene, so to speak,
right.
Has been a big part of keeping the Bonzer project, you know, moving ahead. I mean, Duncan and Davey Miller really, you know, showed that, put time in on the North Shore and showed the board's work there and,
right.
and you know, kept things alive.
Final question for everybody interviewed is just, what was the last surfboard that you rode?
I had to make a board for a file for some boards we're doing with Patagonia, and it was a 6.7, one of the Rush Short models. So I had to make a board for them to create a file off of. And so I said, oh, heck, I'll just make one for myself. And I rode that, a 3-fin one. And
What is it? What length? And explain what the Rush Short is.
It's Rush Short. It became known that... kind of naturally, we didn't specifically name it that, but people were saying, I want to ride one of those boards like Russ is riding, and then We just sort of gave into it and said, okay, well, I guess it's going to be the Rush Short model. It's basically a 70s, our 70s sort of mainstay, the mainstay template that we were using during the mid, you know, mid to late 70s. Sort of wide point forward, diamond tail. You know, a lot of people, it wasn't anything super unique other than that it was a Bonzer. I mean, it was more of a single fin, 70s kind of single fin template.
Yeah.
And again, wide point forward, 70s profile with the beak, you know, thicker beak nose. And that board is, we've made so many of them. It's been really surprising to me how many we've done. And the feedback on them, both mostly three fins, but some five fin versions.
Did you see the Instagram that Pat Towersy posted a day or two ago?
He
posted a photo of Kai Lenny
riding
it.
And yeah, without I think it said he was riding it without the center fin.
Right. What I remember Pat saying was that that is the best board that he's ever ridden.
Oh,
it's his favorite board.
Right. Yeah, he did say that. We got to make him another one because he had broken it. I think he put it back together, and I think that picture is after it was put back together.
Oh, okay.
He's had that board for quite a few years. Yeah, that's Pat, what I mean.
Pat rides everything.
I know.
Like, Pat rides high-performance thruster shortboards and does airs, and then he rides crazy long paddle boards, you know, on giant waves. And he said that was the best board he's ever had.
It's been pleasantly, more than pleasantly surprising.
Yeah.
But it's been because I've made them for really good surfers, and we've made them for, you know, regular guys, whether they were guys in their, you know, 60s, 50s, 40s, and lately now some younger guys are trying them, and the feedback it's been gratifying, but more than anything else, it's just really interesting because people are going out on those boards and surfing. It gives them, what it's done is you can ride something that's got that sort of vintage look and volume and so forth, but you can surf it at the top. You can surf it at the top of your ability.
Right.
It's not going to limit. Obviously, the template shape dictates a little bit in terms of, in terms of the characteristics of riding, but you can still surf to the top of your ability on the boards. And I think that's, you know, that's what's been surprising to people, and I think that's what's, you know, I was in France. I did, you know, a few weeks ago, and, you know, 15 of them, even in France. We've done, you know, a ton here, and it's been a lot of fun. And like I say, it's very interesting.
It's got to be gratifying to see that feedback.
Yeah, it is. It's cool because the gratifying part of it is that because we went out on the limb when we were kids, and we said we knew we had something that was of value, and that was our prime. And we felt that we had. Because we really believed and knew, really in every fiber of our being, that this design had value, that we had a response. We took it on as a responsibility. Again, not to blow our horn, but the Bonzer would not be being surfed all over the world today if we hadn't have just, you know, maniacally stuck with it.
Right.
And we just shaped them. We weren't making our living off of it. I always had a second job up until less than 10 years ago. I always had a second job.
Yeah.
And we continued to make the boards because keep it available, keep it alive. Because, again, we really cared about contributing to surfing and surfboards. And that was really the fundamental drive to keep it alive.
Excellent. Well, thank you for sharing your story.
Yeah, well, thanks for the time.
Absolutely.
Yeah, appreciate the opportunity.
Bonzer5.com is the website. Or, of course, just come over to SurfSplendorPodcast.com. We'll have a link to Bonzer5.com, as well as photos, videos of everything that we discussed in today's episode. All of it's on SurfSplendorPodcast.com, as well as an entire archive of every past episode of Surf Splendor, all 86 of them. It's all for free. Come check it out. Leave a comment on today's show's page and engage, all right? Thank you for listening. Thank you for sharing this show with friends. Thank you for your generous reviews on iTunes. And follow us on social media at Surf Splendor. All right, we'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Surf News. Until then, this is your host, David Scales, signing off of Surf Splendor and reminding you to shred on.